Control freaks are common freaks. In other words, it's not freakish to be a controller. When we use the word freak, it's usually meant to mean someone unusual, extraordinary, out of the normal. And so when people speak of a control freak, it's usually saying this person has an extraordinary, unusual, rare determination to control everything and everyone, everywhere, at every time in their lives. But all of us have that trait to some degree or another. Sometimes it's very obvious, it's quite active, it's aggressive, verbally at least. It's evident and obvious to all. Other times it's more passive, but no less controlling. It's more manipulative maybe, more subtle, but no less powerful and influential and damaging, both to the people around that person and to the person themselves. This desire to micromanage everything, to keep everything exactly lined up. Ultimately, as many counselors will tell you, whose offices are full with people who suffer with this controlitis, ultimately, this controlitis is exhausting. It's overwhelming. It cannot be sustained and is ultimately extremely damaging to that person. Those who have studied this have found that controlitis is often a reaction to childhood events or events earlier in life, maybe in their teens. Events such as trauma, abuse, neglect. Some people who lived through war as a child suffer from this controlitis. Children who live through conflict in the home very commonly eventually react to this sense of chaos and unpredictability with this determination to get control and keep control of their lives. So it's really a reaction to the fear of being out of control, the fear of losing control. And in fact, if we can say anything about the last year, it's probably multiplied controlitis. Because very few of us have ever felt so out of control, have we? Our very organized, orderly, predictable lives, it was all turned upside down. Our home life, our educational life, our work life, our church life, our national life, our business life, our internationally. The whole world has seemed to us to be out of control, and our little worlds have been felt to be out of control. And really, you look at the media and you wonder, do they have a vested interest at times in maintaining this? You know, just as COVID seems to be coming under control, suddenly we have Chinese rockets falling out of the sky. It's just like, how can we create pandemonium and panic and fear and a sense of uncertainty and unpredictability? And our reaction often to that is to try and grab and get and keep even more control. So we want to ask this question, who is in control? Who is in control? Do we have this evening's slides anywhere? That's this morning's. Somebody want to try and help out a bit? We'll leave it there just now. Who is in control is our question. And we want to just look, first of all, at the chapter as a whole, just to try and break it down. Because I'm sure, like, if you're in the habit of reading the chapter before going to church, you probably gave up about verse 10. Because you look at it and you think, why is this in the Bible? It just seems to have no relevance and be extremely confusing. So let me try and break it up a little bit. In verses 1 through 20, we have multiple kings and multiple battles predicted. So Daniel here, he's living about 500 BC, and he lays out here a list of battles, kings, conflicts, and so on, that will happen over the next 200 to 300 years. That's verses 1 through 20. Then in verses 21 through 35, it all seems to focus in on one king who is engaged in multiple battles himself. He seems to be a much greater king, more powerful king, and this is the king. He's come up in our previous studies of Daniel. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes, who was at work ruling around about 150 BC. Oh, we have our slides. Good, thank you. Who is in control? So we've got multiple kings, multiple battles, one king, multiple battles. And then from verse 36 into chapter 12, verse 4, we have one king and the greatest and final battle. In other words, we are pointed towards the Antichrist and the very end of time. So that's an overall picture of the chapter. Multiple kings, multiple battles. One king, multiple battles. One king, one great, final, ultimate battle. So what's our answer to the question, who is in control? Well, our first answer is this: the controllers are not in control. The controllers are not in control. So we read Daniel chapter 11, and the general impression we get from Daniel chapter 11 is chaos, disorder, unpredictability. And it's so complicated that we can't really figure it out. We look back in previous chapters of Daniel, and there were difficult chapters because of the symbolic language, the picture language. Here, it's complicated because of all the political and military language. Who can figure all this out? Well, people have tried. In fact, one of the commentaries I read listed 45 historic events that were predicted in this chapter and which came to pass. And it goes over in this commentary maybe 15 to 20 pages. Goes through each verse, has a date, has a king, has a battle or a conflict or a treaty or something. 45 battles, allegiances, treaties, covenants, marriages. One commentator said this: all this history is difficult and complicated and not particularly interesting. It's almost impossible for anyone to remember for long the precise history of all the relationships between the different nations, the Egyptians, the Syrians, the Ptolemies, the Seleucids, the Greeks. Then he says, we shouldn't be too concerned if we don't have a detailed grasp of Middle Eastern history between the Old and New Testaments. Aren't you grateful for that reassurance? Our survey of it in this chapter has been little more than superficial. It didn't feel like that when I was reading it. But basically what he's saying here is, don't get bogged down in the details. Yes, scholars can look at it. They can list all these verses and all the parallel events. But what's the big picture? Let's step back and sense what God is really saying. And what he's really saying is this. These powers, these 45 powers, are not that powerful. These controllers, these kings, these leaders, these Caesars, these generals, these controllers are not really in control. Because they rise and they fall. They come and then they go. They strengthen and then they weaken. That's the cycle of history. However powerful, however great, however much in control they are for a time, eventually that control runs through their hands like sand or like water. They think they're in control, but they really aren't. None of them last very long. Even as we'll see, Antiochus himself came to experience that for all the massive control he had, he really had ultimately none. The controllers are not in control. Now, I believe that's really comforting for God's people. The controllers are not in control. We have our own controllers in our own day, don't we? It might be a president. It might be a CEO. It might be a nation. It might be an ideology. It might be a philosophy. It might be an attempt to control society through the media. There are controllers in our own day, and at times they seem really powerful, really strong. We feel almost as if we're in their grip. But just like Daniel 11, they are not in control. No person, no nation, no ism or ology can hang on to control for long. We're reminded as we survey this history and all of history that the controllers are not in control. And if there's somebody or something or some party or some company or some organization or some nation that you fear, and that fear is controlling you, remember, read Daniel 11 and realize they are not in control. Time and again, as we'll see, they came to an end. Sooner rather than later. So, we take comfort, but we also give something. We take the comfort of the controllers not being in control, but we also give. We give up our own control. We give up our own attempts to be king or Caesar or the CEO or the president of our own little lives and kingdoms. It's easy for us to point to this person, this corporation, this organization, this country, whatever, and say, oh, these are the controllers. But we've got to point the fingers to ourselves. Because, as we've said, to one degree to another, we are all little controllers of our own little worlds and our own little kingdoms, trying to keep everything under control, and it causes us a ton of pointless stress. It's overwhelming. It's exhausting. It cannot succeed. We will utterly fail at this. Some ways, chapter 11 gives us a big picture of the small picture of our world. And it calls us to give up control to the controller. To bring our lives to the Lord and say, God, I can't do this anymore. I never could. I tried, failed, tried and failed. Tried this tactic, that tactic, this pressure, that pressure, this influence, that influence, this manipulation, that manipulation. I've tried it all, and I failed. I've damaged myself, I've damaged others. And so I give control to you. I hand it over. Because I don't want my life anymore to look like this. Controllers trying to control the uncontrollable. And ultimately ending up out of control. So to sum it up, controllers cannot control. Controllers cannot control. I see a lot of women nudging their husbands at the moment. But really, it's a little picture, isn't it, of who we are. You know, we'll take the smallest little thing and try and get power and influence and control. We don't like giving it up. And yet, what's really obvious to see with the remote is often everywhere in our lives. We just can't see it so obviously. And it's really, this chapter calls us to take the remote out of our hearts and hand it over to God and say, you're in charge. You pick the channel, you pick the volume, you pick the program. I'm in your hands. You're my controller. So the controllers are not in control. Let's look at the positive side of it now. God is in control. God is in the cockpit. God is at the wheel. God has the remote. If you look at the three sections we referred to in this chapter, these first 20 verses tell us that God controls all of history. So 45 events predicted and fulfilled to the letter as the next few hundred years pass. What does that tell us? Somebody's in charge. You know, the predictions are so detailed and so fulfilled in detail that critics of the Bible say Daniel was not written in about 500 or so BC, but rather about 100 BC. Because these critics say no one could ever have looked ahead and predicted everything in such detail, and it all was fulfilled so exactly. And so they say this was actually somebody who was living about 100 BC, long after the events, and wrote history to look like prophecy. That's how incredibly accurate this prophecy was. This is not, though, history dressed up as prophecy. This is a prophecy of history. It's a prophecy of what would unfold in the years ahead of many nations, many kings, many treaties, many alliances, many marriages, many betrayals. It's astonishingly accurate. And it's telling us God's in control. In fact, if you look, for example, in verse 27, just give you a few examples of the further underlinings of this. As for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. So keep that phrase in mind, the time appointed. Then look at verse 35. At the end of it, it says, it still awaits the appointed time. And then in verse 45, at the end, he shall come to his end with none to help him. So we're being told here, all these events have been appointed, they've been organized, they've been set out by God, and they're being fulfilled one after another after another. And if you were God's people living in this time of fulfillment, think of how massively encouraging this would have been to you. It maybe wouldn't have meant much to Daniel when he made this prophecy, but if the people who lived afterwards, God's people, were reading Daniel, as these events were unfolding, they would be thinking, this is like deja vu. Is this something that's happening again? Because I'm sure I heard about this before, and then they realized, no, I actually read of it before, but before it happened. And event after event came through, strengthening them, comforting them, encouraging them to put their confidence in God's word. History written hundreds of years before by the God who controls history. God controls all history. And then, secondly, God controls the opponents of his story. God controls the opponents of his story. Now, there were a number of these in these earlier verses, but it all focuses on Antiochus Epiphanes. He was one of the greatest leaders in that 500 or so year period, probably the greatest, but he was also the cruelest, the most devious, the most greedy, the most violent, the cruelest, most vicious leader. In fact, his name, Antiochus Epiphanes, he gave himself the name. Epiphanes means illustrious or magnificent. And so awful was his opposition to all that was good and true that people gave him a nickname. Instead of Epiphanes, they called him Epimanes, which means not illustrious, but madman. Madman. That's what they called him. That's how awful his rule was. But look at this beautiful verse in verse 32. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. So Antiochus came to God's people and God's land, and he managed to persuade a lot of God's people, the Jews, that he was on their side. They came over to his side. But notice this. But the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. In other words, although some were swept away by Antiochus, some by violence, some by fraud, there were others. There were God's true people, his remnant, that knew who God was. And as a result, they took action, or as the older version puts it, did exploits. They were heroes and heroines of the faith who stood up against this great opponent. A writer of history who's researched this said this: spiritually perceptive men circulated secretly among the people, teaching them the scriptures, leading them in prayer, and keeping alive the hope of the Messiah. The work continued unabated, although those that did it were relentlessly pursued and punished by the sword, the stake, imprisonment, or impoverishment. The lengthy and cruel persecution was a period of much real faith and much true religion in the heart. Now, what motivated these people of God to do such exploits, to take such heroic and courageous actions in the face of this tremendously controlling person? Well, we're told the people who knew their God. This was rooted in theology, in a knowledge of God. They knew God was in control, not Antiochus, the madman. The all-wise God was in control. And therefore, they took action. It wasn't God's in control, we'll just do nothing and sit back with our feet up and wait for this sovereign God to do whatever he's going to do. No, it was God's in control, therefore, we can trust him. We can go forward. We can take steps. We can keep going with the cause and the kingdom of Christ. And it's interesting, we've seen already some of the verses. But look again at verse 29. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south. Also, verse 35, until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. Again, in verse 36 at the end, he shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. See, God's not actually mentioned in these verses. His name isn't there, but he's there. His appointment, his sovereignty, his rule, his control is evident throughout this chapter. God is in control, even of the opponents and even of this opponent, Antiochus. And then thirdly and lastly, God will control his greatest opponent. So he's in control of all history. He's in control of all those who oppose his story. And then he's in control of the greatest enemy yet, who is still to be revealed, the Antichrist. In this chapter, those who studied it have said that there's a break between 35 and 36. If you read into verse 36 to the end, there's a lot in there that can't fit Antiochus Epiphanes. And this fits a regular pattern of prophecy. What the prophets often do is they'll prophesy something quite soon that will be visible and physical, like blessings for Israel, or judgments on Israel's enemies, or wars. And then as they prophesy that's near and visible and tangible, it's as if they sort of lift off, they take off to another realm, another plane, and through these immediate, visible, physical blessings, judgments, they see, ultimately, spiritual and eternal blessings and judgments. They see that these immediate, near, visible events that they're prophesying, when they come to pass, they're, as it were, like a springboard to take us into the very end of time and all eternity. And that's what happens here. It goes from this great, near, visible enemy of God's people, Antiochus, to the ultimate, greatest enemy of God's people, the Antichrist, and the final battle. So Antiochus is really just a mini Antichrist who's a picture of the big Antichrist. God is in control, though, even of that. Notice what it says at the end here. He shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. Even the greatest, most vicious enemy of God's people is in God's control. He will come to his end and none to help him. As Paul puts it in 2 Thessalonians, God will destroy him with the breath of his mouth. He'll just blow him away. God is in control. So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us persecution cannot stop communion with God. Whatever tough times are ahead, we can be verse 32 people. People who know their God and do exploits. No amount of external opposition or devilish opposition can stop God's people from serving him, worshiping him, being on mission for him. They can close churches, they can ban the Bible, they can take books off the bookshelves that offend them, they can make it hard for Christians to get work or keep work, but they can't stop Christians communing with God through Jesus Christ. And lastly, trust God's control. Trust God's control. You know, In the UK, very few Christians put any hope in politics. And do you know why? Because we're so few. Like 2% of people go to church in Scotland and England. So the hope of Christians having any influence or impact through politics is zero. But they pray. They don't agitate politically, but they pray. Sometimes I think over here, Christians still have such numbers and significant influence politically that our attention can get taken up with that kind of control, that kind of political control. And we seek to advance God's kingdom through control of politics and of people, of society, of organizations, through agitation, irritation, friction, which actually ultimately damages the cause of Christ and the witness of God's people. And so this chapter is really saying spiritual problems are not solved with political solutions. Spiritual problems are not solved by us thinking we're in control and we have to solve them. Spiritual problems are cured with spiritual solutions, spiritual weapons, with prayer. Over-involvement in politics can be, it's not always, but it can be a wrestling of control from God and taking it to ourselves. If we know God, we will trust God and we'll trust God's control. So let's hand over control because we can't handle control. Let's hand over control because we can't handle control. We're not up to it. We don't need to be. God is up to it. And he calls us, hand it over by prayer to me. So who's in control? The controllers are not in control. God is in control. Therefore, count on God to control his story and your story. That's a necessary conclusion from the Lordship of Christ. How much do we believe that Jesus Christ really is Lord or controller? We measure that by how much control we give to him practically in our everyday lives. Let's pray.